Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
Today, six things three entrepreneurs now know about starting a business. Each of our guests plunged into a competitive part of the economy, and they use their know-how, their experience, and let's face it, some indomitable optimism to get their companies off the ground. So what kind of hard-won wisdom and sage advice can they share with us? And if you've started a business, I'd also like to hear from you via Twitter. What's the one thing that every would-be entrepreneur should know? You can tweet me at Carrie, K-E-R-R-I-M-P-R. Our guest today, Dara Beavis, is co-founder of Wise Inc. Publishing. Welcome. Good to have you here.
Hi, Carrie. I'm excited to be here.
Alex Steinman is co-founder of The Coven, a workspace for women. Welcome. Good to have you here.
Thanks for having me, Carrie.
Davis Sensman is founder of the Davis Law Office, where she also advises entrepreneurs. Welcome. Good to have
you
here.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Alex, I want to hear all of your origin stories through this conversation, but I want to start out with a question. Do you think female entrepreneurs are born or made?
I think you have any entrepreneur has to have some kind of like risk-taking, Evel Knievel bit in them.
Yeah.
But I think there is something to like being taught about risk-taking and grown into that. And I think that's why there aren't very many women entrepreneurs who make it, you
right.
know, because they aren't taught to, not very many are taught to negotiate, are taught financial acumen and business acumen. And that's a growth strategy of ours is to help women get there. But I think that's a huge gap is just that knowledge base. I think men are inherently taught to negotiate for salary, negotiate for deals.
What's the thing that you can be taught about risk-taking? Davis, what do you think?
That's a good question. I agree that there's just a baseline willingness for risk that kind of runs through every entrepreneur. But I think the things you can teach are really the knowing your worth part of it. When you're, you know, when like Alex said, you kind of have to, it's like a muscle that you have to be willing to take a risk and then be willing to negotiate for yourself. And it's something that, you know, I don't think we are, at least for me, it wasn't driven into me when I was a young girl, that was something I should do or something I should know how to do. And I think that's, but you can train that part in. You can train the, like, for every negotiation that happens where you get something, I think it's a little bit more of like, oh, I can do this.
Yeah,
I can.
Yeah.
This is, if I ask for more. So I always tell clients, like, you don't get what you don't ask for.
Good. Mm-hmm. Good advice. Dara, what do you think? Risk taker. Were you born as a risk taker? You had to learn the upside of taking risks. What?
I definitely had to learn to
okay.
take risks. I'm an oldest child. I'm a rule follower.
Yeah.
And it was one little risk at a time, and I think that's what lots of entrepreneurs learn, is that the biggest risk is obviously to start your own business, and then I think your business grows and is made great over time because of the little risks that you take every day.
Okay, I love that because I think we tend to think of women entrepreneurs as, I was all in. I put it all on the table.
Yeah.
And what you're talking about is incremental risk and how essential that is.
At least that's how it works for me. I think that's how it works for my authors, especially our women who write books. It's a huge risk to put your all into this product that's going to be consumed by millions, hopefully.
Right.
And I think that our women authors are usually the ones who ask me to make their name a little smaller on their cover. You know, if they could, you know, what if I just do a little book first?
Oh, my gosh. Classic.
Yeah.
Classic women undervaluing
I'll do a soft
themselves.
Cover. It's always my male authors who are like 6x9 hardcover with a dust jacket with foil and emboss.
So was there incremental risk here, Alex? Or what? Or is there this sense of with the coven that, man, you're laying it all on the table?
Well, I think there's never going to be a right time to jump into a business.
That's a great point.
You're never going to feel, it's like having a baby. I've had two now. And like, you're just never going to be ready to be a parent. You're never going to be ready to be a business owner. And ready is whatever that means to you. Like, it's never a good time to like quit your job, take out of your 401k, no. go into debt, like, you know, stop seeing your family. Like, there's just, like, stop seeing, talking
and
to friends.
If you knew all of the sacrifice ahead of time, would you do it?
No.
I mean, if you think about, if you think about what happens in, like, the first year, but I mean, but it's great, you know, but you right. also wouldn't not do it. Like, I don't think any of us right. would be like, oh, I don't wish I was still sitting in a law firm working for someone else.
No, so naivete, yes. I mean, in some yes. ways works is to your really advantage. Essential.
Yeah. I have a gym that posts the workouts the night before, and I can't look at them or I won't go. So it's like the same thing with opening a business.
Yep.
You don't know what you don't know. And so
and that's good.
Going in a little naive is helpful. But I do think, like, you do have to just kind of take a leap at some point. You can only prepare so much. You're going to run into so much when you start a business that is just, like, totally unknown. Like, I don't know how plumbing works today. Our coffee machine wasn't working because the plumber turned off the water as he was installing a shower. It's like, we just,
beautiful.
You just don't know that that's going to happen. Yeah. So I went to Starbucks and bought 2 carafes of coffee. Like, you just have to be on your feet constantly.
With it. Yep.
You have to continue to evolve to meet your audience, to meet your stakeholders. And if you're not doing that and taking little risks throughout your entire business journey, like, you're probably not in business anymore.
So, Dave, of the three of you, Davis, you're the one with the most experience as an entrepreneur because you've had the law firm for 8 years.
Yeah.
What's the thing you now know that you didn't know then?
For me, I think it's really, especially in my industry where people have a vision of, like, what a lawyer is and what a lawyer should be. And I mean, for some people, it's still one of my law partners is, you know, a very tall blonde mom. And she, you know, last year would get asked, like, what do you do at the law firm? And she was like, I lawyer.
That's what I do. You know?
Why? I thought you were going to say that you don't meet
well,
the
Well, I certainly don't. But I think they just, I think that just for some people, they can't wrap their head around, like, women attorneys. Yeah. And I for sure don't look like an attorney.
Can we say why, since this is radio?
Sure. So I am, like, pretty gender ambiguous. Today I have on a flannel and ripped jeans.
And you've got tattoos.
And I have tattoos.
What is that? What are those tattoos of?
That's a train track.
Okay.
Because when my son was two, he was really into trains.
Not your mama's usual lawyer.
Exactly. So for me, when I first left my firm, I kind of set up a shop that was just like a, you know, I rented space from other attorneys and just had kind of an office. It looked like any other lawyer's office. I still was, you know, kind of in the typical mold of, like, I need to dress up every day and this is what lawyers do. And then I realized that, like, the people hire a person and, like, the more you feel comfortable as who you are, the more they want to hire you. And so I just kind of slowly realized, like, I don't need to have an office like a regular lawyer. We office out of co-working spaces. We have for, you know, the past 7 years. And you know, people pointed out, like, you don't look like a regular lawyer. And that's what I like.
So, Dara, how do you think you break the mold of what publishing now, and I have to say, finally publishing is loosening up a little bit.
It's been very slow,
but I still
slow,
bet
Carrie.
That you feel like you are breaking some of the perceptions. How so?
You know, I have yet to come across another Black woman who owns a business in the publishing world.
Wow.
Not a single one. So there's that.
So when you go to a convention of Black women who own businesses in the publishing
it's just you. It's just me.
Whoa.
You could count authors who self-publish. Mm. There are lots of Black women who are self-publishing brilliant work.
Yeah.
And I get to work with a few of them, which is really awesome.
So you're also breaking the mold in what self-publishing is all about.
Absolutely.
Too, right?
I mean, I think what I've learned in the publishing world is that we're really slow. I mean, I think that I went to Yale last year and got to, you know, network with some of the bigger publishers and got to know them. And, you know, publishers are people that like to read.
Yeah.
And they're not really innovating. They're obviously not tech people. You know, they're book people. And I get that. So what I've tried to do is get people in the publishing world to see authors as the real commodity. It's not book sales. It's not, you know, Amazon. I mean, authors are really the life force of books. Their ideas are what make books exciting.
Oh my gosh, I love this. This is it's so high time.
Yeah.
Is the publishing world, you know, waking up to this?
No.
No.
Right. It's good. It's your competitive advantage.
That's right. Exactly.
Okay, Alex, how do you break the, you know, the mold of what we think of as young entrepreneurs?
I mean, our entire business is about creating an intersectional space for women and non-binary folks to come as any version of themselves. And so, like, me personally, in a space like that, there's not a lot of spaces that look like ours. Yeah.
How so?
I mean, the majority, when we lean more towards community space, but we are a co-working space. There are people working there right now. There's a sense that, you know, there's only a type of person that can be in a co-working space, like a tech person or a man, or a lot of the spaces that are around the area were built by men. And yeah, so the design of them and the aesthetic of them, or there's no mother's room, or there's no prayer room, or there's no space to just be and relax. There, it's really about productivity and getting things done. And so what we've built is something that even if you have a 9-to-5 job, this could be a space where you could come first thing in the morning, maybe at lunch, maybe meet somebody, mentor, mentee, somebody. And I think, like, you can kind of be all of those things, work on a side hustle in the middle of the day, and then go back to your day job feeling refreshed and ready to get back to work. And I think it's a space that you can kind of evolve in. A lot of our members are in this transitional period of their careers where they're, you know, maybe mid-level and thinking about leaping into entrepreneurship, but want to be around people who've done it.
You're listening to a Friday Roundtable. It's one of our six things roundtables. Every now and then we gather people in the studio and ask them, tell me the six things that you wish you'd known when you began. Today, it's three women entrepreneurs who have gotten into a competitive marketplace, and some brand new, some with some mid-level kind of medium experience. Davis is the experienced, the grand dame of them all.
The grand veteran.
With 8 years, which is exciting. So we're talking about what they, how they assess the market and where their companies fit in, but also really more about digging into themselves and understanding why this felt like an imperative and understanding yourself better. All the things that women entrepreneurs talk a lot about, I hope, among themselves. Davis Sensman with us, founder of the Davis Law Office. Alex Steinman, co-founder of The Coven. It's a workspace for women. And Dara Beavis is co-founder of Wise Inc. Publishing. And as you listen in on this conversation, if you've started a business, particularly as a young woman, I'd like to hear from you via Twitter. What's the one thing that every would-be entrepreneur should know about what you've been through? Before you get into this, here's the one thing you really ought to know. You can tweet me at @CarrieMPR. Dara, what would you say that is for you? The one thing that somebody who's taken the plunge, you'd say, before you do it, know this.
You shouldn't judge your big picture based on what today looks like.
What does that mean?
Because I think as an entrepreneur, every day is so different. There are days where we're doing super well and the account looks awesome. And then there are days where I cry about the fact that there's not any money in the account. Yeah. And so I just have learned to go with the flow and to know that your big picture is what it is and your day to day is what it is.
Davis, what's the one thing? And you advise entrepreneurs. So,
yep, that's who we work with, too. I think a huge thing for me was finding my people. And so, like, being, because so if my firm is having like a terrible day, if it's like, why is no one paying us? Mm-hmm. Look at all this accounts receivable. Nobody will ever pay us again.
Yeah.
Like that's
yes. Never. So there's a again. Little catastrophizing
yeah,
that goes on there sometimes.
Okay. It absolutely.
If
happens.
I'm having that, my actual coworkers who work in the firm with me also are having that. And so it's amazing to be around other businesses who are not having their worst day and who are like, oh, I just landed this big account, or someone paid me, or, and so for me, it was really important to like find your people. Not every business can run 100% of the time out of a co-working space, but you have to go out and find other
Absolutely.
Business owners who like share your values and who on your worst day, there's someone who's going to be having their best day and you can remember like, oh, that was me like 2 days ago.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It'll be me tomorrow.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, I was thinking about this, Alex, with the voice in your head that says there's a model of what a successful law firm, business, you know, whatever it is. And we all, whether we want to push that away or not, we know that's in our heads, right? It's seeped in through the culture.
Yeah.
You know, how do you deal with that day to day?
One of the biggest pieces of advice that we ever got was that we need to stop calling it a business idea and start calling it a business.
Why?
Because when you walk into a space and, you know, I use the building piece because that was like the biggest piece of chunk of change that we spent right away. But it was like, you know, we have a business idea and they're like, okay, cool. Probably won't last very long, you know, and people don't take you seriously when you just say it's an idea.
Yeah.
But when it's a physical thing and you can start to talk about, you know, the hundreds of women that we've interviewed or the people who've invested in us through our crowdfunding campaign, or you start kind of talking about the women who are a part of our organization, like Davis and like Dara, and you know, you name drop a little and people start to say, oh, okay, this is a legit business. And I think, you know, another thing for us was we have a social mission of creating this really amazing intersectional space where women can be there, you know, lots of diversity in our space. And people automatically think we're a nonprofit. And so when we say, no, we're a for-profit with a social mission, that's another thing that like piques men's interest of like, oh, they're a business. Like, so it's kind of giving those cues constantly of saying, no, we are legitimate. And we do have to constantly prove ourselves because we are bucking the system of what we look like. I even think between our co-founders, when we started looking for a space, two of us, myself and Aaron, my co-founder, Aaron Farrell, we would go together and the real estate brokers would only talk to her. She happens to be a white woman. I am not. And so the fact that there was even just that a little bit of like, I would ask a question, they would respond to Aaron. And then I would ask another question, they would continue to respond to Aaron. And and I think that's just so common. And that's the type of discouraging things for women that they decide not to go forward with starting a business.
Right. Dara, how about this idea of it's not my dream. How do I want to put this? It's not just, I'm just working on my dream. You know, the dividing line between no, it's real, and this is how I'm getting from A to B, even though, yes, you are fulfilling your dreams too. You know what I'm saying? The language around that to be taken seriously.
Yeah, I think
I think women deal with that in a way that men probably don't. But
When you said idea, yes, absolutely. I got a lot of that too, because before your business is a business, it is an idea. And you're excited about it and you want people to be excited too. But how you frame it is important as a woman. I mean,
so how did that work for you?
For me, I remember when we first started Wise Inc. And saying we are a publisher, getting some sort of rate. Oh, you are. You are. You know, what does that mean?
Veiled skepticism. Not
veiled
so veiled
skepticism. Okay. Absolutely. And my co-founder is a woman also, Amy Quayle. And so we're women owned. And Amy is a little bit younger than me. And I was in my early 30s when I started Wise Inc. So I think ageism also comes into play. So when you're talking about my dream and I get to live this dream, I think that people started to pay attention when we started to talk about our authors and that we work with some really powerful folks in the Twin Cities and in the country. And we had to name drop to get, you know, some of that credibility. And also when we got closer to $1 million, that's when people started to pay attention, when we started to say, well, as a $1 million business, we are making these amazing and important decisions.
So, Davis, the language of female entrepreneurship. How do you talk about that with your clients?
I do a lot, because a lot of them, if we pitch, so we do a lot of presentations and a lot of education, because that's just like an important part of our mission is to, you know, we can't work with every single business in the Twin Cities or in the state, but we can provide information. And a lot of them aren't at a place where they're going to be able to pay us. So we, you know, figure things out and we do presentations and we'll sit on panels. But if we pitch something as being for entrepreneurs or for business owners, that room will be overwhelmingly filled with men and with white folks. And if we pitch something as for people starting something out, or for people with a side hustle, or for people who have a business idea, we will get a much more diverse group. Because, and I always tell people, like, you are a business the day you do something And in exchange, somebody does something for you. I don't care if there's no money
exchanged
yet. Yeah. I don't care if you're, you know, a house painter and you're painting the house for someone who's going to make you some meals. Mm-hmm. You're a business owner. But getting to the point where the people identify as business owners, and particularly for women and people of color, is a much, much further down the road than, you know, because it's like, well, people aren't taking, you know, people aren't acting like I'm a business owner. And so I don't feel like what I'm supposed to.
So did you feel that from the beginning?
No.
Even when you first opened that?
No.
That
and I
office?
Left my old firm. I always say it's because they kind of were, I counseled my clients all the time, like, don't be in business with people you don't want to be in business with. Like, make sure that every owner of your business is someone you share values with.
Yeah.
So you're all kind of rowing in the same direction. And I realized at my old firm, like, oh, the partner, like, that's your goal, is to be a partner. And I was pretty close. And I just realized, like, oh, I'm not rowing in the same direction as all these folks. So I think I'll leave. And it was 2010 and the economy was terrible. And attorneys couldn't get hired. And people were like, what are you thinking? Like, leaving. And I was just like, I just can't stay one more minute. Like, I can't tell my clients to do one thing and then not do it.
Yourself. Wow.
And I knew that I was too expensive for the clients I wanted to work with, and I knew I could cut my overhead. But I didn't think of myself as, like, a business owner. I thought of myself as just, like, an attorney who practiced on their own. And I guess it probably wasn't until I, like, hired my first employee, which I kind of stumbled into. I just met her for coffee and was like, you should come work for me.
And that's the moment you thought, yeah, I'm running a business.
Yeah, this is a business.
Yeah.
And like, then how did your perception of who you were and what that meant change?
It made it a lot easier to demand what I was worth, because I wasn't just thinking about my value. I was also thinking about Emily's value. So I was like, oh, no, you're going to pay us far more than that. Emily's very smart.
She is very worthy.
Capable. Yeah. Yes, she is worth all that money.
Yeah. I mean, in some ways, too, it began, I'm not just, I'm projecting the values of what we are, right? Through, not just through me, but now we've got somebody else here, and together we're presenting kind of this united idea of what we stand for.
Yep. And now we're a thing. And then we kind of, as we grew, then we realized, like, we had to completely overhaul our marketing, because it was just an attorney practicing on their own. And I was like, no, now we are a thing. Like, we are bigger than just the sum of our parts. And, like, we have to show people that.
You know, Alex, so I just use that phrase, what we stand for. Mm-hmm. And for me, that's a really important principle to be clear on. But I've often wondered if women get much more caught up in the idea of, I want everybody, you know, audience facing.
Yes.
What do I stand for
when
it comes to starting a business than men do?
There's some bit of, like, you're not ever going to have your story buttoned up enough to call yourself legit or to feel like you're legitimate. You just have to start acting that way. And then people start taking you seriously.
Absolutely.
And it's that reciprocal nature of, like, I'm going to call myself a business. You're going to treat me like a business. And then somehow we're going to do business together.
Yep.
And it just happens kind of like that.
Yep.
But I think our four identities, and I think Davis kind of touched on this, like, in the process of building a business, you really come into your own, you know, personally and as a business. You kind of find your voice. You find your mission. And the reason we all left the advertising industry or have left agencies and businesses where we were working for people was because we didn't feel like we fit in there. And essentially, we started finding our voice in spaces that, you know, wanted to decrease our voices. And that we just had to be okay with leaving and finding our own voices and starting a business where we could just be the voice. And sometimes that's scary when you start talking and you're like, oh, I can only hear myself. I don't have anybody to, like, approve this.
Like, I can only hear myself. You know, that is great.
You know, make a website and you're like, who needs to approve this?
Can we just put this out there?
Or I, like, made an invoice and it's like, well, I guess I can ask Davis, my lawyer, if this looks okay. But, I mean, literally, like, you're the boss. And when you start to find your voice and stop hearing everybody else's criticism or stop hearing what everybody else wants you to be as, you know, a business owner, as a mother, as a, you know, coworker, whatever that is, like, your mission is forward then that's all that's left is just you and your mission. And so to that point of, like, how you tell your story and wanting to get everything, like, ready and set, it's like, as soon as you start behaving like a business and you start
shedding all of those things that you've been told not to do for so long, your mission and yourself will just project that.
Dara, five years in, again, in this very traditional business that you're in of publishing, do you feel like you're treated as kind of, and there's this fun little entrepreneur thing over here, or do you think that there's some recognition that you're really on to something and you're pushing change? I mean, is there a moment when you thought, I'm not just going to do this for us, I'm going to do this for the publishing industry at large? Or is that still too...
You know, we started as a blog first. And so that was a very non-traditional path to entrepreneurship.
Wow.
Certainly a non-traditional path to publishing. But what that did for Wise Inc. was it really helped us draw our line in the sand around who we were, what our voice was going to be. And we sort of established ourselves as really passionate book people who wanted to tell the truth about the pitfalls of publishing. And so we were, I mean, that's sort of where the Wise came from. So we're just going to tell you what it's like to be out there writing. And it's hard, and it's sometimes isolating, and it's, you know, it's also hard to market a book. It's not easy to, you know, build fans over time. And so we were really, you know, establishing our voice early on by accident, kind of. We weren't doing it, like, on purpose. Like, we're going to tell our story and make sure people know who we are. But what that did now for us now is, you know, we've gotten to a place where people know who we are, and they know that we are, we have convictions. We really want to publish books that are fostering tolerance and growth and social change. And so we've gotten authors through the door because they like the books that we put out there. We've published Humans of Minneapolis, which is a super cool project. And so I think as a publisher, you have these books out there that kind of speak for you. And that's been really great. But I do think as we move into year five, I want to challenge Wise Inc. even more to kind of follow the footsteps of Davis and Alex and make sure that we're really curating the kinds of authors and clients that we want to work with a little bit more intentionally, that we're really pushing the envelope more, that now that we've got a track record of doing this fun stuff and working with wonderful authors, you know, what's the next? And I think that's also what an entrepreneur is always asking, like, what's the next?
And this is the way I hear you describe this. This is that incursion into, okay, now we've done this and now we're going to influence the publishing business, right?
Yeah.
Tall order, but you feel like you're kind of on the precipice of that.
And it's such an interesting time in history. I think people are fired up. And so I've just been asking, you know, what is a publisher's role in this environment where people have a lot that they want to talk about and write about and teach others? How can Wise Inc. be a force among all of these wonderful things? Sometimes not, they don't feel very wonderful, but I think as a publisher, I'm thinking, wow, this is going to make great content. We're going to look back at this time in history, and we're going to look at the books that were written, and we are going to be really... We're gonna be better for what we learned during that time.
I love your perspective on that. You're listening to the Friday Roundtable. It's one of the roundtables where we ask people with various different experiences what they wish they'd known at the beginning of that experience. We've got three female entrepreneurs here. What does it mean to start a business? What does it mean to develop that conviction? Love that word you used, Dara. And we're going to get a look at the latest news. And when we come back, I want to talk to my guests about self-doubt. What happens when you have that moment of, I'm doing it, can I really pull this off? And I don't mean the natural questions, but really that, who do I think I am? You know, those moments. What do you do with that? So we'll come back and continue the roundtable. Just a minute.
Good morning. I'm Phil Picardi in the NPR newsroom. Southern France has faced another terror attack as an armed man opened fire on police officers and took hostages in a supermarket today before being shot dead by police. The attacks in a region around Toulouse follow a string of other extremist violence in France in recent years. The conservative House Freedom Caucus says it supports the idea of President Trump rejecting a $1.3 trillion spending bill. Republican Mark Meadows of North Carolina, chairman of the House Freedom Caucus, says in a tweet the group would fully support a veto, adding that Congress should pass a short-term budget resolution. Trump has threatened to veto the funding bill. President Trump is charging ahead with remaking his White House with an appointment of a new national security advisor. Trump is bringing in former UN Ambassador John Bolton, a foreign policy hawk, to replace H.R. McMaster. The Justice Department has charged 9 Iranians in government-sponsored hacking that pilfered sensitive information from hundreds of American universities, private companies, and government agencies. Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein and other law enforcement officials say the Iranian defendants are accused of working at the behest of the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps. And a teenage girl who was shot when a classmate opened fire inside her Maryland high school has died. The St. Mary's County Sheriff's Office says Jalen Willie died last night. More news ahead on NPR News. The time now is nearing 10:37.
I'm Laura McCullum, managing editor at NPR News. It's Member Appreciation Week, so on behalf of everyone here in the newsroom, thank you. With your membership, you power stories that matter and events that strengthen communities. We're so grateful for your support.
Programming is supported by The Guthrie, now playing Familiar, a new play about a Zimbabwean-American family preparing for a wedding in Minnesota. The New York Times called it engrossing and fiercely funny. Through April 14th, tickets at GuthrieTheater.org.
Support comes from Second Harvest Heartland. 1 in 10 is at risk of going hungry. Second Harvest Heartland gives more people access to food because food changes learning, health, and communities. Food changes everything. More at Second Harvest Heartland at 2harvest.org.
Should cameras be allowed in Minnesota courtrooms? I'm Mike Mulcahy. Proposed legislation would end an experiment that allowed more media coverage of criminal trials. We'll talk about it at 11, and I hope you can join us.
Increasing clouds across the state this afternoon with high temperatures in the mid-30s to the low 40s. Cloudy skies tonight, snow and a slight chance of freezing rain. Low temperatures in the low 20s to low 30s. Teens near Lake Superior. Some more snow expected tomorrow morning. Most of the snow in western and south central Minnesota. Right now, partly sunny skies, 37 degrees in the Twin Cities. In St. Cloud, it's fair and 33. In Duluth, fair and 31. This is Minnesota Public Radio News. The time is 10:38.
I'm Carrie Miller, and you're listening to the Friday Roundtable. We have gathered a group of women entrepreneurs to ask them what they know now that they wish they'd known at the beginning. And we were just talking about developing that sense of conviction around your business and then what happens when self-doubt intrudes. And that's natural. Dara Beavis with us, co-founder of Wise Inc. Publishing. Alex Steinman, co-founder of The Coven, and Davis Sensman, a founder of the Davis Law Office, and she also advises entrepreneurs. Okay, self-doubt. And Dara, you said you're in a moment where you're thinking about this because you're at the five-year mark.
Yeah, and, you know, I think for the first 4.5 years, it felt like a really fun, exciting startup, and the building aspect of growing our business was really cool and fun, and the challenges were different. Now we have a staff of 7. We have a lot more people that we're responsible for. Our overhead is higher. Wise Inc. was completely self-funded. We were incredibly lucky to have clients and authors from the first day we opened. And so we've gotten really, really far with bootstrapping. And so now at this 5-year mark, it's time to do things differently. It's time to grow differently. It's time to market ourselves differently. And the cost of doing the things that we want to do, like, that cost is a lot more than what it was 5 years ago.
So is this where the panic is coming in?
Yeah. And I've vented to lots of friends, including some of the ladies at this table, about the panic of capital. You know, do we do that?
Yeah,
that's a big commitment.
Do you let other people in, right, to be investors and influencers in the business?
Right.
Scary.
And also what I made prior to starting Wise Inc., I'm not making that right now.
Yeah.
And so I think as an entrepreneur, you have some really tough conversations about what is important. I got to go to Jamaica for a month in December, and also I make considerably less than what I would make if I worked for another publisher.
Right. So, Davis, when Dara calls to say, I'm in this moment of panic, what's your advice?
I mean, it's often like, what like what is happening? I mean, I say to a lot of like when clients call, and it's often with like a particular issue, but then you have to kind of dig a little and say like, we often say like we're much more like therapist and advisor than we are like actual lawyer.
I'm getting that sense.
True. Yeah. And so you have to dig in and say like, well, what's your immediate issue that you're dealing with, and what else is in there? And you know, our job is to remind our clients and the businesses and the business owners we work with that like you are doing it. Like you're doing it every day. You're keeping other businesses in business. Like if you mm-hmm. weren't doing it, then we wouldn't be, because you're our clients. Right. You know, and just to explain to them that like this may feel like you've never dealt with it before, but that doesn't mean someone else hasn't. You know, we all run into really similar things, but there's no, you know, organization for mm-hmm. business owners. And so it's isolating, and you feel like, God, made the worst mistake.
So, Alex, what's ahead of you is the cool hip startup,
yeah.
right?
Sure.
At some point, right now, you're loving so that. You're in the middle of that.
Amazing.
It's the best of times.
It is.
But at some point, you're also going to face the transition from the cool hip startup to
yeah,
it's real
right.
and it doesn't feel quite so hip.
Right.
You prepared for that?
I don't know. I mean, yeah, I hope so. I think one of the things that, you know, we're constantly thinking about is what does growth look like? So we have our 5-year plan, we have our 10-year plan, and likely none of those will happen because it'll just like continue to change, right?
Yeah.
So those you
it's
can plan all you want, but things will develop and evolve. But I think, you know, for us, we just want to serve the community. So if the community is saying that we need this, we're going to go help them make that. Right now, we are the solution to a need that women are asking for. I mean, we've been able to raise almost $300,000 mm-hmm. on crowdfunding in a few months. And that just shows that's a testament to like that people want this in the community, and that there isn't something like this out there that is serving such a broad, diverse group of women and non-binary folks. And I think what we're going to continue to need to do is to listen to our members. You know, Davis mentioned like being a therapist, like you're my mm-hmm. therapist, but I'm also a therapist for
yeah.
all of my members.
Yep.
I had a
mm-hmm.
woman come in on day 2 yesterday and said, I don't feel like I was like touring the space with her. And I said, this is a parent and prayer room for our new moms. And she said, I don't feel like I'm being a good mom. And she melted into a puddle into my arms. And I literally yeah. needed to be there and catch her for that. And I think mm-hmm. all small business owners, and, you know, I have a unique business where I am interacting with women who have unique issues. But all small business owners end up doing that for their clients,
absolutely.
You know, especially ones with like, you know, Dara, you're in the business of storytelling, and,
yeah.
and Davis, you're literally everybody's therapist. Lawyer-pist? Is that a thing?
Lawyer-pist, I like it.
Lawyer-pist.
But it's true. I mean, I think we do have to continue to listen to our members and listen to our constituents.
You know, Davis, mm-hmm. when I hear that sounds right. And then I think, but you went into business with some principles of what this business was going to be. And, you know, then come the voices going, but no, we need, and how difficult that may be to carry the original principles with whatever the market's mm. telling you.
Yeah. And it is important. I remember when I left my firm, I had only done transactional business work. So basically everything short of suing, like we
yeah.
do everything for business owners. And now we have folks that do some suing, but I don't do that. And I remember people saying, like, well, what type of law are you going to practice? And I was like, the same type I've practiced for like 6 years. And they were like, oh, you won't be able to do that on your own. Like, you won't.
Mm.
How will you get? Because and a lot of small firms or solo attorneys tack business on at the end of a long list of mm. things they do, because it seems like, well, I could review a contract or I could do. But there's so much more to it. And there's like so much more of a service you can provide. But we did have to listen to our clients in a lot of ways because
that you didn't expect.
Yeah. Like
yeah.
that we had to, you know, we've added attorneys sometimes based on things that our clients need. Like when my clients were like, yeah, you'll help us plan out, you know, our buy sell agreement for our business. So we know what happens if one of us dies, what happens to the business. And then I'd ask them like, so does your personal estate plan match this? And they'd be like, What personal estate?
What is that? Yeah.
And then we realized, and I would say, well, I'll send you to someone who can do it. And they would say like, nope, I just want you to do it. Or I just like, you be the go-between. You realize like, oh, this is a need you have. You want me to solve it. Mm-hmm. I can solve it.
Mm-hmm. One of the, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to add that, like, with a lot of people probably look at that, and male business owners in particular, and they're probably like you're not going to make any money doing everything for everybody.
Right,
or
right,
and
yeah.
they look at us and do the same thing, mm-hmm. where they're like, well, you know, you can't give memberships away for free, or
right.
you can't make a payment plan, or that's going to be too much work for this.
Mm-hmm.
And so, I mean, we do that so that we can service more people at our mission, to serve
right.
our mission. And you do that too.
Right. And I mean, we may not, like, if someone has a complex litigation need, we may not be the ones who are going to handle it. But I will serve as a go-between for my client, because I know, like, they need, they're in a moment of crisis and they need someone they trust to handle it. And
oh, yeah.
I don't need to charge them extra for that because it's something I don't do, or an attorney I haven't found. And people are like, well, how do you make money from that? And I'm like, you don't have to make money from every single thing you do.
It's like, right? the more personal your business yeah. is, and the more you care about the clients, the more skeptical people are
yes.
about how much money you're
exactly.
going to make. Right?
Exactly. Yeah. Like,
yeah.
Well, and to be honest, I think you end up probably making more money than other folks.
Absolutely.
Because, you know, that person who couldn't afford whatever at that time might come back down the road, you know, or you help them through something, they refer your business. Like, there's so many, you know, it's more of a personal relationship than it is, like, just about the bottom line or just about the business.
And that's something we tell service providers a lot, because they, you know, when you're small, or, you know, when you own your own place, when you're, whether you're an accountant or an attorney or a publisher or mm-hmm. really anything, you're scared to turn away business. But sometimes the best thing you can do is say, like, listen, you're not valuing me, or your values and worldview don't line up with mine. So I'm not the best fit. So you should go find somebody else.
Yeah.
And that's a big thing. It took me a while to realize, like, oh, wait, we can just fire clients. We don't have to keep
or say no.
Yeah. Or just say that
yeah.
we're not going to be a good
That's
fit.
One of the
yeah.
things you really had to learn.
Yeah. That was a tough one.
They don't stand for what we stand for, this client.
Right.
It's so liberating right. when you get to do that.
And,
or when
and,
you feel like you can
yes.
finally.
Dara, have you done that?
2 weeks ago. Absolutely.
Congratulations.
You know, it was awesome. It was awesome because it was the person that I knew. I had worked with this person in the past at a different place, and they found Wise Inc. and wanted to work with us, and I knew it wasn't going to be a good fit. I knew that it was not going to end well. I knew that I wouldn't have joy. I knew all of those things, and I knew that we would be okay if we didn't take on this business. And like Davis said, you can say no. There's no rule, law, article in
no.
any constitution that
no.
says
exactly.
you have to work
no.
with everybody that wants to work with you.
So, Dara, as you come up to this 5-year precipice and you work through who are we and what are we doing,
mm-hmm.
how will you do that?
I think definitely having our community at the Coven is going to be great. Having our people, as Davis said earlier, I think having our people is really important.
Yeah.
Because you do need people to talk you off the ledge. I also think being okay with failing is
mm-hmm.
fine. I mean, I think you fail a lot as an entrepreneur. You hire clients that aren't the right fit. You say yes to things you shouldn't say yes to. You say no to things you probably should have said yes to. And you spend money on things that you probably shouldn't have spent money on. And so I think in this next leg, I will be okay with knowing I'm going to fall. I'm going to have to get back up. I'm going to make poor choices, and they are going to be hard to swallow in the moment, but you keep going. And I think that's what entrepreneurs do super well. We keep going and we keep going and we keep going. And you know, from time to time, that you will have some doubt. You will wonder about going on LinkedIn and looking at what job opportunities are available.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then you snap yourself out of it because you remember you get to be off for 2 weeks if you want to. And you get to go hang out with your friends at the Coven if you want to. You get to fire
and
a client.
This is yours.
Mm-hmm.
And this
yeah.
is mine. Yeah, absolutely.
I did want to talk. I'm really glad Dara brought up failing because mm-hmm. I want to talk about this. So when you talk among your partners mm-hmm. at the Coven about how you're going to deal with failure, it's pretty inevitable.
Yeah.
Some kind of failure.
Yeah.
How's that discussion go?
So we don't really have a lot of time right now. So, I mean, when we talk about failure, you have to move on so quickly because, you know, the plumber's coming, or because the, you know, we got to get open, or I got to go be on NPR. Like, you know, we don't have time to sit and
reflect yet.
And yeah. So I think down the road, as we consider how to make moves, and I get this question a lot because we have four co-founders, and yeah. So it's a lot of ideas. Mm-hmm. But to Davis's point earlier, is we're all rowing in the same direction. And so mm-hmm. as long as that's the case, we might disagree about how to overcome a failure. But we're going to get to a solution because we don't have time to not. And when you don't, then you don't have a business anymore, you know, or somebody has to go. And that's just not an option for us. For us, it's like the four of us have built this thing to both sustain or to support the community, but to fill each other up with Dara's word, joy. And that's what we find when we're together, so that we fail together, but we also really flourish together. And that's the most exciting part about this business is turning to my right and looking at my business partner and saying, holy crap, we just did that. We just opened this thing. And then like waiting by the elevator and waiting for our members to walk in at 7:15 in the morning.
You know, Davis, this is why I waited for a while to bring this up, because I don't want it to be failure to be heard as the business didn't succeed. Mm-hmm. I don't think that's necessarily
right, sure.
failure.
Right,
we
yeah.
learned something from it. We,
that's true.
We're joyful in the process. But what do you say to would-be entrepreneurs and people that are in the middle of it about it didn't fulfill what I thought it was going to?
Yeah, I mean, we have that with clients sometimes where they're like, I got to, and sometimes we have to have the conversation with them about like, I think you should shut this business down mm-hmm. and you can still do whatever you're doing, mm-hmm. but you got to do it somewhere else. Making them realize that this is not your failure. This is just something that happens. And there's a way forward. Like, basically, this is not going to define you. You still have your skills. You're still good at, you know, it's not a failure to say, I did that on my own for 4 to 5 years, and now I want to go do it somewhere else where I don't have to be the boss.
This is kind of what I meant, is about the emotional idea of what it means to, I tried it. It didn't work out like
right.
I thought it was going to. I think women grab onto that quickly and say, I failed.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. I think women, we are taught like, well, if it is not, you know, doing X, Y, and Z, then maybe you should just quit and go do something
perfect.
Else. If it's not perfect. If you're not making enough, you have to give it up because you need, you know, your family needs more money, or you need healthcare or whatever it is. But I see a lot of men who are really more men who are really unhappy, who own a business and are really unhappy in it.
They're just grinding it out.
And I'm always like,
you can stop doing this
any time.
Yeah.
If honestly, if it's not bringing you joy, like Dara said, like, why would you do this?
Because you're making money.
Yeah, I think that's it. And because you cannot, you know, you have been socialized to be unable to say, oh, well, I don't, that's just a failure of like, it's your whole identity and your manhood and your, you know, whereas I think we, as, you know, who have not been socialized that way, like we have more stuff going on. Like,
yeah, but if you look at all of the big entrepreneurs that we admire, Steve Jobs you know, Bill Gates and all those folks, they have had several iterations across their career where they started something, built something, did something else, came back to it, did something, you know, for women, we don't think of it that way, but we should.
Yep.
We should know that you can build lots of things over the course of your life. You were designed to do that. We multitask and create as good as everybody else.
Yep.
And so this leads well to the question I wanted to ask you all as we wrap it. Who is there an entrepreneur, somebody in your life or just somebody in the world that you really admire and think they exhibit the values of how I think of what it means to be an entrepreneur?
You know, I guess she's an entrepreneur in a way. Shonda Rhimes, in her book Year of Yes, and it gets to that question about fear. She talks about how she's had this fear of public speaking, and that whenever she would get up to a podium, she thought she was going to like die. And once you get over the hump of not actually dying, then you realize that I'm going to be okay on the other side of this. Knowing that, and her whole motto of like Year of Yes and saying yes, and that also means saying yes to saying no, mm-hmm. which is okay too. Mm-hmm. She's kind of this just inspirational person that I think of all the time. Like, I'm not going to die in this situation, and we are going to move forward from it.
Dara, how about you?
I'm going to say Oprah. And the reason is because after her what, two-decade-long amazing career as Oprah Winfrey, creator of the Oprah Winfrey Show, when she decided that she was going to start this network, everybody was like, what are you doing? You don't need to do that. That's not going to work. Who has a network? and I've been watching her as she has slowly started by choice from the ground up to do something different.
And it hasn't been completely smooth. What I really respect about this.
I love
this.
It. I just,
there's been a lot of coverage. Oh, it's going down the tubes. And she's pressed on.
She's not been
afraid sometimes to talk about how she's had to kind of reinvent the idea of what this was going to be.
She's learning a lot. I mean,
right.
Oprah Winfrey is learning
new things.
I know. Mm-hmm. So that's who I'm watching. And the fact that she's, I think, 60?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm
well, she's 60, Dara, and she's reemerged as a pop culture icon again.
Yeah. Again.
Like, you know, she like went away for a bit, and then now she's like on Tito Queens. Like, she just, she's a person who just keeps coming back up. She's relevant.
Davis, how about you?
Hey, Oprah.
You know, I would say one that like just helps me and is like a voice of reason a lot is Nancy Lyons, who owns Clockwork.
Excellent choice.
I met Nancy over the past few years, and it has been amazing because she is also in an industry that is typically heavily male dominated. She's, you know, she's in a business where she's kind of the face, but she has partners. You know, I can check in with her and say, like, what am I going to do? Like, I have all these meetings and it's good, but then I don't bill any time. And like, and she's like, no, that's what you should be doing. That's how business grows. And like, yes, you can say no to that thing because you're like, you're important. You're doing. And
here's the thing I love about Nancy, and I think this is important to the conversation. And full disclosure, she's on our board, so no, I don't have to say this, but I'm happy to say it. I think Nancy's willing to say when she doesn't know something.
Yeah. Yep.
Oh, I think that's pretty rare in the entrepreneur.
And sometimes Nancy calls me and says, "Hey, I have this issue. Help me talk it out."
But she'll say it publicly, too. She's not just saying quietly behind the scenes.
Nope.
She's also learning in a really open way and willing to say, I didn't get it. I get it now, which is powerful. I think in the business. Hey, thank you all for a great Friday roundtable. Thank you.
Thank you, Carrie.
Dara Beavis is co-founder of Wise Inc. Publishing. Alex Steinman is co-founder of The Coven, a workspace for women. Davis Sensman is founder of the Davis Law Office, where she also advises entrepreneurs.